Hi, this is Billy Sherwood of Yes, and you're listening to the Yes Podcast.
This is John Davison, and you're listening to Yes Music Podcast.
Hi, this is Jeff Downes, and you're listening to Yes Music Podcast.
Hi, this is Steve Howe, and you're listening to me on the Yes Music Podcast. Have a good time. Listen. Bye.
Hi, this is John Anderson. You're listening to the Yes Music Podcast.
Hi, this is Rick Wakeman of RW, and you're listening to the Yes Music Podcast.
So we have a proper meeting of the ways now. Mark is here. Hello, Mark.
Hello there, Kevin, and hello there, Jeff.
Yes, Jeff is here as well. So, international man of mystery, Northern Irish Jeff is here, star of stage and screen and serial collaborator and great friend of the show. Anyway, hello, Jeff.
Serial eater, I think it's probably more appropriate there. Yeah. Hello, everybody. Hello, Mark. Hello, Kevin.
Hello. Great to have you here again this week. Now, we're talking about this Keys to Ascension and Key Studio question, and we've got some comments to read out and some audio to listen to in a minute. But first of all, Jeff, Mark and I had our say on this last week, so I'm interested in what you thought at the time when the Keys to Ascension 1, let's call it that for the moment, Keys to Ascension 2 came out, and then Open Your Eyes, what your feelings were at the time, and what your general overall impression would have been, or what you think would have happened if Key Studio had come out as a proper full Yes album at the time.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I was trying to think about this last night and cast my memory back, and the thing that came to mind was that there seemed to be a torrent of Yes releases that happened very, very quickly.
Yeah.
I didn't check the dates, but I'm pretty sure that certainly the timeline between Keys to Ascension 1 and 2 was probably no more than a year.
Yeah,
and Open Your Eyes was very, very quickly after that.
Yeah.
And I suppose, you know, the union kind of that wasn't quite what we thought it might produce in terms of glorious Yes music. And then we had Talk, which had great moments, but probably, you know, maybe wasn't 90125 quite. Mm. And then suddenly it seemed here was kind of the classic lineup back together producing some music. I thought the two tracks on the first Key to Ascension album were absolutely fantastic. And then the second one came along. And I do remember at the time listening to Keys 2 and the studio tracks and going, to me it was kind of better studio music mixed with not so interesting live music, so it wasn't quite as exciting a release. Keys 1, you know, you had some of the live tracks that were unusual and deeper cuts. Keys 2 was kind of the stuff that has pretty much been on every Yes live album virtually, and so I found Keys 2 studio stuff much more interesting. Then Key Studio came out, which had everything on one disc, and I mean that is one of my favorite go-to Yes albums. It really, really is. And so, you know, in terms of what I thought at the time, I loved all the music. I loved that we were getting what was sounding like proper, you know, classic Yes music of a very, very high quality music. That even just by I can remember glancing at the sleeve of Keys 1 and Keys 2, and actually seeing that the tracks were, you know, lots of co-writes, you know, a bit written by Steve, followed by a bit written by Chris, and, you know, and it sort of looked like the credits that you would have seen in the early albums, and it sounded like it. I was very excited about it. Open Your Eyes, as I say, in my memory, Keys to Ascension 2 and Open Your Eyes came very, very quickly, and it was sort of a, what's this? It's an album that I still enjoy. You know, it has a lot in its merits, but it there was things that it didn't have that Keys had, the Keys tracks had in spades. I also remember the reading Notes from the Edge, which was the website that had a kind of a newsletter at the time. And I remember reading quite there's an interview on there, and I don't know if you guys have talked about it already, an interview with Rick, which is just before Keys 2 is being released.
Hmm.
And he is saying, there's 48 minutes of music here. You know, Keys keys to Ascension was, here's some live tracks, here's a studio track or two to tell you we're back. Now we've made a new album. He didn't want it labeled anything to do with Keys to Ascension. And I read that, having heard it, I went, I could see why. I could see why that would have, you know, actually, never mind Keys Studio, the 48 minutes of studio tracks of Keys 2 would have made an absolutely fantastic album, I think, at the time. And I think might have taken the band in a different direction. But, you know, it didn't happen, so it didn't happen.
Yeah, yeah. It was a surprising and unusual decision to make a series, as it were, of two discs, well, two double discs of CDs at the time, of Keys and then Keys 2. And in some ways, I can't really understand why they did that. So with a different title, with different artwork, as others have said, Henry Potts, etc., have said, then perhaps that could have been a fantastic one. Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you, Jeff. So let's move on to some comments that we've got. And our friend Jeremy North has commented, and he's putting a rather alternative view, and that's exactly why we do the Yes Music Podcast. Mm-hmm. Yes fans do not have the same views about anything. Mm-hmm. So he says, I'd have bought the live album and not the Keys new material and saved a few quid. This is the point at which I realised that Yes had given up trying to be creative and just wanted money for nothing. Now, I can see the point in reference to, for example, the number of live albums that we've had, particularly recently from Yes. However, I don't agree with Jeremy there. And clearly, Jeff, you've just said that you really like this material. And I've said several times now that Key Studios is an album that I can put on and enjoy just as much as a number of other and older and newer Yes albums. So let's start with Mark. Can you work out what Jeremy means exactly about giving up trying to be creative and just wanted money?
I'll preface my comment by saying, you know how much I love Jeremy. Jeremy's a great guy. He's always, me and him always have some sort of a frantic sort of relationship with our comments, but I love the guy and I know that he loves me. So I'm going to preface that and then say that I have no clue what he's talking about, because quite frankly, to say that this is like not they lost creativity is complete lunacy, because it's probably some of the most creative stuff they had done at that point. I mean, if you compare that music to 90125 and Big Generator and even Union and that stuff, I mean, this is music that, to me at least, sounds like they're going back to the kind of music that people were complaining about they weren't writing.
Yeah.
So why not be happy that they wrote this kind of stuff? I love it. I'm in the same boat as you and Jeff. I mean, I've listened to this album frequently. I mean, even long before we decided to talk about this, I listened to Key Studio quite a bit. I love those songs, you know? So I think that it's a return to form in a way. And I've said before, too, that I think some of them are lost classics.
Mm-hmm. So Jeff, I think what he's getting at is that this was a sort of retread of previous material and trying to do a Yes of the mid 70s or early 70s. Does it feel like that?
That's
to
what
you?
People want.
Yeah, well, that's so. Is that what people want, Jeff? And do you see what where that's coming from?
I mean, at the time, I think it was what I wanted. I think the question is, were they doing it for the money? You know, I don't know. I'm not sure to what extent these things sell, but I wonder, is there's something that I uncovered when I was just doing a bit of my research before this, and it was in the back of my mind. Again, notes from the Edge. Chris Squire was interviewed actually after it had come out, and the interviewer had asked him, why did things happen the way they happened? And I'll read you the quote so that it's not me giving an opinion. It's me reading the words of Chris Squire.
Yeah.
We did have a target date to get it delivered to them, the record company, by the end of November, because we have financial reasons we want to do that, because they promised we could have some money for Christmas, so we're trying our best to do that. So there was an element of this where the Keys to studio tracks, did come out, if you interpret his words the same way I do, in the way that they did because there was money coming.
Yeah.
I don't think they were writing that type of music to make money, but maybe that's part of what he was
But don't forget,
to.
though, don't forget, though, too, a lot of record companies have these kind of things written in the contracts where they say that if you can deliver a record by so-and-so date, we will give you a little bit of something, mainly because on their end, they see much more dollars if they can release a record, say, before Christmas,
right?
Mm, so yeah. They're trying to give sometimes these bands some incentive to, you know, get off their rear ends a bit and work on stuff quicker so that they can both capitalize. As that's how they kind of look at it.
It would just be a shame if that was the thing that determined the direction that happened with this material that, by the sounds of it, we all love.
Mm.
Well, it's definitely not easy music to write.
Well, no, that's what I was going to come back and say, Mark. You know, there's no way that this is forced. It doesn't feel forced to me. It doesn't feel like, you know, it was a real struggle like something like Big Generator or one of the others that they've really, really went through the mill to try and produce something worthwhile. I think it seems to flow and shows a great deal of creativity and certainly... It seems to me like the musicians are enjoying playing together, enjoying creating in the studio or you know, however it did come about, and that you can't create this kind of really again life affirming music if it's just, you know, about the bucks in the end.
And I think I mean, I alluded to it earlier on, but even the writing credits demonstrate that, you know, just about everybody chipped in something to it. You know, and I mean, I was looking, I mean, I know people who listen to this show are probably into some of the facts. So Mind Drive is a Anderson, Squire, Wakeman, Howe, White credited track.
Mm.
Now, I wonder, guys, do you know how many such tracks there have been in Yes history?
Not very many.
Very few.
Three?
Okay. So the answer is... or at least based on my research, and I'm sure there's somebody here who will tell me I'm wrong, the answer is that there have been six.
Oh, gosh.
But,
right.
So six being the four from Tales from Topographic Oceans.
Yeah, okay.
Mind Drive and Future Times from someone's favourite album. But also then, and I don't think this quite counts, but if you actually look at the CDs, the Paris... Roy Thomas Baker tracks are all jointly credited, but my guess is that's probably more a political move than a writing move. But yeah, you know, so how many, but even just the spread of writing credits, you know, between, you know, from an album where, you know, was largely written by Trevor and John preceding it, and even Tornado, which had more of a spread, it you know, it does feel like a collaboration that they actually wanted to do by the sounds of reading it, Billy Sherwood being the cement that put it all together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think one of the things which really sticks out to me when I listened to it again this week was the things like, and I mentioned this last week, the sparring between Howe and Wakeman, and I don't think that's the kind of music you could get if you are, you know, going through the motions and getting something done. They did really seem to be playing off each other. And I think Rick Wakeman said that Chris Squire produced some of his greatest bass lines, actually, in this material. And you know, I think it's remarkable. Let's just move on to John Parry. He came back and said this on the show notes. No doubt there is good music on Key Studio, but it is a lesser album. I don't think it is money for nothing. I think they were just not as coherent and focused a creative force as they were in the early and mid-70s. Lots of water under the bridge, lots of branching out and growing apart. By contrast to Key Studio, I think Magnification shows what happens when they were able to work well together after all, or at least four of them, and The Ladder shows what happens when a third party is able to guide them. I'm sure glad to have the material as a separate album. I enjoy it quite a bit, but it is no Tornado. Ha. And honestly, it's better to keep the studio pieces separate from the live performances. I can't be the only one who thinks that the studio pieces suffer a bit in the original releases from being put next to the live performances, especially the first volume. Be the One and That Is are perfectly nice songs with lots of lovely parts, but they are just not in the same league as the live material on that album. And... that's a question I did want to ask both of you. Start with Mark. Why did they, as if hide away the studio tracks on the second disc of each of those albums. What was in their minds?
Well, I have a feeling that they didn't put those other ones on and make it a double live CDs, because I think there was issues with those tracks. I mean, I remember mentioning to you before that when I had listened to Keys 2 on headphones, I can clearly hear that there's some vocal overdubbing being done on some of these tracks. I think that there was some issues with it that had to be resolved by Billy and the guys. They had to go back and fix up stuff. So I think rather than, you know, spend extra time fixing all that up and then releasing it as a double record, they just said, hey, you know what? We have some of this material. Why don't we just take some of this and fill up the, you know, disc two with some of this stuff, and then we can just have time to finish working on this stuff and put it out on a second volume. That's my theory. I don't know if that's 100% correct, but I mean, I know what I've heard and I know what I hear when I listen to that disc. And, you know, I have a feeling that that's part of it, because other than that, I can't see a feasible reason to do that if you had all the material already ready there.
I do remember reading one of the band talking about there being a bit of a jigsaw puzzle, you know, being done between the sort of five or whatever it is, three or four or five nights that they actually played, and kind of comping, you know, the performances together, which is the thing that created the problem. If you've ever seen the horrendous DVD, which is about 70% of the screen is embellished by imagery to hide the fact that the band aren't actually in sync with what you're hearing most of the time. So that rings true.
Yeah. So, but Jeff, if it had been you, would you not have put the new music on the first disc each time?
You know, I can see it either way. You know, I can see how, I think this is a problem of what happened. You know, Keys to Ascension, let's take what Rick said as being right. Keys to Ascension was the, we're back, you know, and here's whatever it is, you know, an hour and a half of live music, you know, a live album, with, you know, with Roundabout, with Starship Trooper, with Siberian Katru, and with a few deep cuts for the fans. Oh, and by the way, here's some studio tracks to whet your appetite. We're back. Wait and see what comes next, right? That template has been created. The band decide not to go down the route of producing a studio album. So what do you do? Well, it seems like you have to make Volume 2 sort of the same as Volume 1 and make it a live studio combination. What's the lead track in Keys to Ascension 2? It's I've Seen All Good People. So again, maybe from a record company head, they're going, well, let's kick off with this, you know, one of the big radio songs that everybody knows that'll help us sell this, because actually, you know, who'll buy this album because of Mind Drive or Footprints, etc., if they've never heard it before. So I wonder, was there a case of playing it safe, put the stuff that people know that's classic up front, and the stuff that we're not quite sure about, we'll stick it on the second disc. I wouldn't do it, but I can see how a record company might.
Yes. Okay, fantastic. Well, let's go over to Simon Barrow now, and something he's sent in with his thoughts, and we'll have a chat about what he says after we've played his.
What if the Keys to Ascension tracks had been released as one album? What an interesting Yes puzzler, one of the many unresolved questions in the history of Yes. I think probably the difference it would have made is that the band might have held together a bit longer, although tensions between certain members of the band and Rick Wakeman and disagreements about management and tours and so on would probably have reared its head again. Looking back, the tracks on both the Keys to Ascension albums are probably much stronger than I and others thought they were at the time. There are elements where you feel that more work could have been done in post-production on the studio. Some questions about some of the keyboard sounds on a couple of the tracks. Be the One is a good example of having a strong middle, but I think a weak beginning, because the ambience on the thing is very, very strange. So certainly the album probably could have done with a wee bit more work. But it would have, I think, made quite a reasonable impact. Undoubtedly, this didn't happen for commercial and production reasons, and I think probably the record company was really testing the water in the way that they released those albums and wasn't at all sure that they were going to be successful otherwise. What about Open Your Eyes? Would we have got that? We might have got it eventually. I have to say I'm somewhat of a defender of Open Your Eyes. There are a few weak tracks on it, but actually I think it's a lot stronger than many people think. I suppose it depends whether you like the multi-layered approach and the more muscular approach to music that Billy Sherwood represents and certainly brought to the band. But there are some extremely strong tunes on that album. And actually, I was reasonably happy when it came out because at least it manifested some attempt by Yes to start to head in a rather different direction. Because I'm not sure that looking back to the 70s was always going to be the best thing. Although the good thing about the Keys to Ascension tracks is that they sound really quite different from the other 70s work. Obviously, the technology had changed considerably by the time that album was released. I think the members of the band had developed quite a bit of musical experience, and they put it to work in really a quite interesting way. And I certainly think that is perhaps one of the great overlooked tracks in Yes's history. Mind Drive, also incredibly strong. I think there are just a couple of weak moments in it, but very powerful. And the other tracks, again, the shorter tracks, although some of them are 8, 9, 10 minutes, make much more impact with listening now than perhaps they did at the time. I think expectations were maybe unreasonably high or shifting in different directions in the different sections of the Yes camp at the time that album was released. So, interesting speculation, and I'll look forward to hearing what others have to say too.
Well, yeah, there you go. And this is the perennial question of Yes, isn't it? Some bands continually reinvent themselves and sound different and have different approaches all the way through their careers. Some bands really retread the same stuff. It's the second time I've said retread today. And Yes, clearly in the 1980s, 83 onwards, 82 onwards, did reinvent themselves. And then sort of in some ways tried to go back to the 60s with this and... you know, as we're looking forward to the newest album, the next album, as it comes out, this is always a question, isn't it, Mark? Should they be doing the same sorts of things? Should they be looking back constantly? Should they be looking forward constantly? Sometimes, personally, I think they've got it absolutely right with, for example, an album like Magnification, an album like Fly From Here, which I think has the right balance of looking back and looking forward. But it's always the way, isn't it? Should they have done this kind of, you know, mostly looking back album, Keys to Ascension, or should they have gone straight on to the Open Your Eyes and tread new paths?
Well, I the thing I love about Yes and always have is the fact that they don't stick to one thing. I mean, that's the true definition of progressive, is to change, to keep progressing, moving forward, changing with the times. I mean, look, Yes have done always what they've wanted to do. You know, I mean, that's the one thing that they loved being, why they would love being on Atlantic when Ahmet Erdogan was running it, because like they said, they let them do exactly what they wanted to do. And we got records like Fragile and Close to the Edge and Relayer and Tales and all these records. And we even got Tormato and stuff like that too. So it's great that they were able to do that. Now, later on, you know, as times were changing in the 80s, they realized that it was either, you know, change with the times or become truly dinosaurs and forgotten to the dusts of time. And they changed it. And they were highly successful with it. You know, and lots of bands did that at the time too. I mean, look at Asia and stuff like that. Lots of bands became more with the times than rather than sticking to their guns with their 70 stuff. Now, as the times went on and people started, you know, clamoring for some of the older stuff, they might have looked back and said, maybe we should try to do some of the more older style material. And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, lots of bands do that as well. They go back and, you know, look back at some of their early material and do those kinds of things. Now, another thing that we haven't touched on here is that when they did Keys, you got to remember, these guys were no longer on any major record label. They were on like a label called Essential, which is some independent label, right? And also when they were on Eagle Rock and these other places, or, you know, these are Beyond Music, these are not major labels. God knows what kind of funding they had available for these kind of releases, and they could have been seriously taking a chance financially, even releasing this stuff for Yes. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So that's a good point.
You know, that's something that has to be taken into account too. Did they have the money to properly promote this stuff, to push it? Because like I said before, I didn't hear squat about Keys 1 or 2 in my neck of the woods. I didn't even know they were out until I went to the record store and saw them and said, what's this? Mm. So that's purely in the record label's lap as well.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think those are very good points. But Jeff, should Yes at any point in their career or now actually think of themselves and try and be that kind of legacy band thing, appealing to people who enjoyed the 70s and want to hear more of that stuff? Or should they still be progressing, and should they have been progressing and not looking back at the time that we're talking about today and about the Key Studio time?
I think so. Mark might be someone who might have a better view on this than me, being that he is an active musician. But I have some friends who are musicians, and when you talk about the creative process, a lot of the time, you know, artists are putting down the material that they've written, you know, or that has come to them at that point in time. I don't think there's necessarily many artists who would say, right, you know, today I'm going to write 1973 style. You know, they get melodies, they get guitar licks, they get whatever. They're not thinking about, is this a 70s one or a 90s one or an 80s one? They're simply, you know, playing the music that is the music that comes to them at that point. And I imagine that, you know, be it Arc of Life, be it whoever, that's what they're doing. Rather than sort of trying to do, well, let's do Awaken Part 2 or something like that. What I thought was quite ironic in this context is actually that, you know, so Keys to Ascension wasn't John Anderson, I don't think, reaching into his kind of, his bag from the 1970s and find, oh, there's a few bits that I wrote back then, let's bring it up. Actually, the time that Yes did do that was Fly From Here, which was the album you referred to there as, as being the one that combined the old and the new in that way. So I don't really think as Key. I mean, I think of Keys as being what came out of the collaboration between those people at that point in time. I'm reading the interviews, I know that, you know, some of them have commented, oh, Billy said, why don't you try, you know, a guitar tone that sounds like this track or whatever. But I don't really see it as them trying to make 70s music. I think part of it is that's what happens when you put those four or five people together in a room and get them to write stuff. That's what you get. And it doesn't sound, you know, if you compare it to the nearest album, it doesn't sound anything at all like Tornado in terms of how they approached it at all. And it doesn't really, you know, there's nothing that you can say, oh, that sounds exactly like. I think it has its own distinctive sound and style that they didn't really tap into again, you know?
No.
But you did bring up a good point, though, when you're saying, do bands do that kind of thing when they write? Because, I mean, I know even when I was in studios many times before watching other bands doing stuff, I mean, those kind of conversations do happen. And I know that for a fact that that someone like Billy Sherwood would have said stuff like that too. Like, hey, Rick, how about you throw down a sort of Moog solo in the style of, you know, because sometimes they are looking for that to get a certain vibe of a song, you know, and if they're trying to get back, I mean, that's the thing. They're not going in there purposefully saying, okay, guys, we're going to write a song from 1974. But if they start writing the song and the producer starts listening to it and saying, hey, this kind of reminds me of this, he'll maybe jump on that train a bit and say, okay, you know what, Alan, we need you to do something like you would have did back on whatever, on Going for the One or something like that. Like they do those kinds of things. Now, I can't imagine Yes being a band that would, you know, fully construct a song based on a time period, but I can see that kind of stuff happening, though.
So it might have come up in the conversations, yeah. Okay, fascinating stuff. And we've got one comment and one piece of audio left. So let's have a listen to Stephen Lamb now and see what his thoughts are.
Hi, guys. Stephen here, just coming back to you with some thoughts about the two Keys to Ascension albums and Key Studio. For me, Key Studio doesn't feel like a cohesive album. It's nothing to do with the length. I just don't think the tracks work together. Though I must admit, I do like Mark's idea about a double vinyl album. Though that feels a bit more like a special edition to me. I think the band's initial plan, which was to park essentially the tracks that are on Keys to Ascension 1 and to concentrate on Keys to Ascension 2, was probably the right one. What's the justification for that? Well, I think there's a disconnect between the two sets of material. And I think the problem is Rick. Although Rick's not absent on that is, and Be the One, his contributions feel a bit tacked on. So, for instance, you get in Be the One, which I have to admit I've always thought of as being a bit of a plod, if I'm honest. It's probably the weakest track over the two albums in terms of studio material. You get those synth scales that are quite far back in the mix, and that's pretty much all he does. And while on that is, he's a lot more involved and his contributions are more substantial, I think, particularly the piano towards the end of the track. He still doesn't sound like he was in the room with the guys, and I don't think he was. Don't get me wrong, I think that is, in particular, is really good. And his relative lack of participation is not necessarily missed. But he doesn't sound like he's part of the band, really. Now, that all changes on the Keys to Ascension 2 tracks, where he feels completely involved. There's lots more Moog, there's lots more piano. And so I think they work a lot better as Yes. The problem with that album is that it doesn't sound finished. So I like the idea of the track Open Your Eyes being added to it. But ideally, to fit in with the tone of what else is on the album, you need something proggier and more substantial. Like most people, I think Footprints and Mind Drive are great. I think Bring Me to the Power feels like a load of bits. It feels underdeveloped to me, though the bits are pretty good. I kind of like Children of Light, and Sign Language is nice, but I don't think it's really necessary for the album. So remove Sign Language, maybe, and put in another 10-minute track of the sort of style and quality of Footprints, and all of a sudden you got yourself an album. Had that happened, and had it been put out as an album in its own right, despite the problems with the tour, Rick might have stayed on board. And we might have had a completely different path for Yes. Pure speculation, but that's what this is all about, isn't it? Thanks a lot. Speak to you soon. Hope everybody's well and safe. Bye.
Good old Stephen, because he always brings things up that I just hadn't considered. And I see what he means. I do think starting, incidentally, the album Key Studio with Footprints is a great move, because I do think it's extremely strong. And yeah, now that he's mentioned that Rick Wakeman thing, it hadn't occurred to me previously, but yes, those are the songs that I like the most, where he does, like he did on the Red Planet very recently, break out the Moog and really go for it in a way that he doesn't really in a lot of other examples of where he actually is in the band on various different studio albums. So Mark, good points from Stephen there.
Yeah, excellent points as always. I wasn't surprised about the Be the One comment, because as I'm looking in his book here, he says in his book here that this is Anderson and Squire at their most aimless and turgid. He's talking about Be the One. So it says here, not that the piece is bad as such, it's just somewhat lackluster, sounding like a band rather tired of life rather than one that is recording together for the first time in 17 years. Now, I don't agree with that comment, but one thing that I do agree with, thinking back to, for example, the that fantastic biography, that Essential Yes one that covered their whole career at that point, there's a bonus disc on there, and they show like rehearsals of the SRO shows there, the ones that became Keys to Ascension. And even back then they were saying that Rick Wakeman was, you know, flying in and out all the time. They could never get him to sit in one place for very long during those times. So it seems like Rick Wakeman was definitely a troublesome piece of the puzzle at that time period. So that could support Stephen's comments about maybe him not being too good a piece of the puzzle in those studio songs, because if he was flying in and out all the time because of tax exile problems and couldn't stick around all the time, then obviously his contributions were minimal.
Yeah.
I mean, there's in the stuff that I dug out last night, there is a Steve Howe quote, which, you know, pretty much confirms actually for all the material what Stephen said. He says it was, again, this is notes from the Edge, and the music was constructed and completed without Rick there at all. There was just space left for him.
Mm-hmm.
So now I know I'm not sure how that relates, that quote relates to some of the bits that are then co-writes, but sign language certainly is the one. I think maybe you could see how it was sort of something maybe pieced together afterwards, and some of the, you know, the intro pieces. But certainly Steve Howe seemed pretty definitive in at least one interview that, what Stephen said, that he wasn't necessarily there.
Yeah, I mean, I always thought that about the tacked on introduction. Which of the songs is that? That there's a Rick Wakeman introduction.
Children of Light.
Yeah.
Children of Light.
And when I got hold of Key Studio and I read the blurb, and I was quite excited about this new introduction. And then I heard it and thought, oh, it's all right, but it really wasn't. I can see why they left it off originally. It's fine and worthwhile, but I can see why it was left alone.
I must admit, I do agree with Stephen that I think the Keys 1 studio tracks are weaker. Mm. I think that actually taking CD 2 of Keys 2 as an album as a whole, I think it actually works very, very nicely. I think possibly works better actually than Keys Studio. And I was reading about this in that Rick Wakeman interview, and this is a bit of homework for people if you don't already know. He talked about the one thing that he had hoped to add to that album is a song called Axis of Love, which is a song that John and him wrote. And I'm sure if you go to YouTube and type "Yes, Axis of Love," I know it's on there. And he said the reason it wasn't on was because it was one that he felt needed a proper grand piano, and they didn't have access to one at the time. Right. I think, I'm sure there's an imaginary playlist with that chucked into it. It might be a better studio album than actually Key Studio, but I would be happy. I'd be happy with that disc too of Keys to Ascension as a standalone album.
Yeah, good stuff. Okay, let's go for the last comment then that we've got, and this is from John Thompson. He describes himself as John Thompson Down Under. Okay, he says, "Hi, YMP. Firstly, my Keys story. I found Keys 1 in the CD shop in Melbourne and hardly recognised any of the songs. This was my first time hearing The Revealing Science of God, Onward and Awaken, let alone the two studio tracks. I thought it was all fantastic, and not having access to the web, thought it was all recorded at the same time. I mean, that is, and Revealing Science of God are both epic numbers. So yes, I thought it was all great, learning later about Tomato, Tales, etc. I then got Keys 2, more knowledge of Yes history, and then the confusing, as it was so closely released, Open Your Eyes. I couldn't believe it was the same band, Keys versus Open Your Eyes. I did buy Key Studio. I think Mark hinted that the sound on Keys 1 is better than Key Studio. Even the Keys 1 studio tracks sound better sonically than Key Studio. The music is still great, and all your good points I agreed with, close to 70s greatness, but not quite. You didn't mention the album cover, which is one of the worst, especially compared with Keys 1 and 2, which look great. Should Key Studio have been released first and instead of Keys 1 and 2? For sure, it sounded like they were on a roll. And while Igor was a good addition to the band, although only three songs, I think, are on Open Your Eyes, Rick was also on fire to me. Return to the Centre of the Earth coming out shortly after Open Your Eyes. This music sounded refreshing in the mid-90s, and it is sad it didn't get a tour or a follow-up. Oh well, such is Yes. So many what ifs. And he also goes on to mention that he ordered the Union vinyl. That's a different conversation altogether.
Let's not go there.
that would take us quite some considerable time. So yes, it's one of those things, isn't it, that the pre-internet days of following a band like Yes, it was mind-blowing, wasn't it? Because I could never understand getting into the band in 1983. I could never understand the chronology. It was really difficult. And this, the you know, this is the period of the band that Dave Watkinson refers to as the messy period. And it certainly was in terms of the management, the labels, the touring, the people not being asked about when the touring dates were, et cetera, et cetera. It was a bit of a mess, and perhaps a no surprise at all that it couldn't hang together. But so tantalizing, isn't it, that they could have gone on from Keys to Ascension to the material there and produced something else. But Jeff, had they continued in the same vein, and were they able to, but given the same lineup staying together, do you think that we would have Yes now, or do you think it might have gone off in a completely different direction and just finished at some point?
Gosh, well, perpetual change. Would it be exactly the same as it was in 1996? I very much doubt it. There's not a lot of evidence for that. Would Rick have stuck around? You know, and I think, you know, probably, I mean, maybe it was a little bit harsh on Rick earlier on, but I think the thing to remember about Rick in this is Rick is pretty much the only member of Yes to have consistently maintained a solo career throughout, you know, his entire time in the band. And so, you know, people are talking about, you know, it's management problems or, you know, Rick had a tour booked. You know, Rick was working away, you know, again, with, I mean, Chris Squire is absolutely one of my favorite musicians, but he didn't really do anything, you know, apart, you know, from that period, really, apart from some of the touring.
Yeah.
So would it have stayed the same? I don't know. I would love to hear what the next album that would have come from the Keys lineup. And I think whenever they did eventually kind of come back together in that sort of full circle tour era, you know, I was really disappointed that was really just a live thing and it didn't produce any studio music. I would have loved to have heard that album. I think that would have been a fantastic album.
Yeah, I mean, and having experienced the band in 2003 at the NEC, and around that time they really were very, very, they seemed to be getting on very well, and yes, like you, I would have loved that. Mark, any final comments from you about that?
Not really. I mean, it is true, though, that it is a very messy period of Yes's history. I mean, you know, they had a new management then, too. I mean, John Brewer had come in to take over as manager at that period of time. You know, they didn't have a record label. They were jumping back and forth from different things. I mean, they had a different record label for Talked and a different record label for this. And for Union, they had something different. So it was really, you know, like a whirlwind of stuff happening. So it for somebody like Rick, who I think is mainly about the music and just wants to get on with writing music and performing, he very much hates this whole business side of stuff, I found. And, you know, so when this kind of stuff comes up and there's delays, he's quick to jump ship, I find, you know. And, you know, on one hand, I don't blame him because I'm also one of these musicians now, too, that is enjoying the fact that I don't have to wait for anybody to write lyrics or wait anybody to send me bass track. I can just do everything myself. And it makes for a much more enjoyable musical experience. Maybe that's part of the thing that Rick likes having, and maybe that's why he doesn't like working in band capacities very long, because there's always something that happens, right? So I think that's why he's never been in there for a long, long period of time. But, you know, like you said, who knows what could have happened if everything was calm waters. If John Brewer would have said, okay, guys, I have everything taken care of, you're back with Atlantic Records, because he said that he wanted to get them back in with Atlantic Records. That was one of his big goals, right? And that never happened. But if he would have had that happen, everything would have went back to normal. They would have got back their back catalog and everything. Maybe it would have been a different story, but we don't know because it didn't happen.
Yeah.
I think the other thing in that is, again, just sort of to expand slightly the point I made earlier on, you know, we talk about Rick and we talk about, you know, him jumping back and forward. If you think about the band's history, you know, setting Yes aside, Steve Howe had a major cash cow in Asia for a period of time. The 90125 guys had a major cash cow in that album and tour. Rick didn't at that point in time. And so Rick was keeping his solo career active because that, you know, I assume that Rick probably, and he jokes about his many wives and divorces and stuff like that. But, you know, Rick didn't have those big income spikes in the 80s. and the 90s that the other guys had. So, you know, maybe some of them were content with a slower pace, whereas Rick was going, I need to keep touring and producing stuff and keep my diary full because I don't have the fallback. So, you know, maybe that's what drove his behavior. And it's not all about the money, but at the same time, it is what it is, really.
Can't survive without it.
But, I mean, it does explain, though, why he made so many of these, you know, new age records over that time period. Because, you know, if it's true that he went through all these divorces, which it is true, you know, he has a lot of alimony to shell out. And you ain't going to be doing that, waiting to release a record every 2 years.
Yeah, absolutely. Fantastic. Well, I've really enjoyed that conversation. Thank you very much indeed, Jeff and Mark, for coming along and having a chat about Key Studio, Keys to Ascension, a fascinating period of the band's history. And I do hope we'll get back together again very soon. So thank you, Mark.
You're welcome, Kevin.
And thank you very much, Jeff.
Thank you, guys, and keep up the good work. Enjoying the shows, and I'm always intrigued every week that you managed to find yet another angle to fill my podcast app with interesting stuff.
Great. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks, Jeff.